Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Freeing up capital to make investments may not be as hard as you think. For those of you who have Facebook accounts, send me a friend request over there on Facebook and LinkedIn to Tahaka Amana Elbay. That's T-A-R-H-A-K-A. Amana is A-M-A-A-N-A and then E-L and of course B-E-Y. And you'll be able to see the actual documents clearly showing you how I was able to cancel my mortgage and property taxes contracts, and that way I have freed up capital for investments. To get the apparatus to do this with, go to www.newdebtelimination.com. That's www.newdebtelimination.com. It's not as hard as you think. Send a friend request on Facebook, and I'll grant that request so you can actually see the documents for yourself. Removing the burdens of debt gives us a freedom unmatched. Peace of mind is something that's very vital to our health. Not only do we want to concentrate on growing our own food and contributing to nutrition, but we also want to free our mind from the burden of stress. Stress is a killer. Go to www.newdebtelimination.com. Look at the items we have there. Before making any selections, you can give me a call. If you have problems with your student loan, if you got a situation with the Internal Revenue Service, mortgage, or whatever it is, go to newdebtelimination.com. Contact me, Tahaka Amana Elbay, 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Remove the burden of debt. Welcome, Moors, to Moorish Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana Elbay, and this evening we are dealing with black people. Now, we're concerned about people of African descent here. Recourse, remedy, and the renouncement of your U.S. citizenship. Now, what is that all about? We're going to get into it this evening. We'll be dealing and answering the following questions. Do you have to recognize your nationality? Should you renounce your citizenship in the United States of America? What recourse should we take with the courts? What is our remedy in the U.S. courts? What does it mean to be stateless in the U.S. as a person? Why are people of African descent treated the way they are in the U.S.? This is what we're going to deal with this evening. But before we get down into this broadcast, I want to make you aware of something that we're going to be dealing with tomorrow night. We have a special guest coming on, and this sister is a film producer and director and have already produced a short film, and this film is located on my website, on my wall over at Facebook, And her name is, let's see, what this sister's name is, Soraya Soifri. She produced a short film called For the Love of God. Now, you can go over there. We're friends on Facebook. And even if we're not, you can go over there on my wall and scroll down. You'll see the ad for tomorrow night's broadcast, and you will see a link to the actual film that you can click on and actually listen to and watch the actual film for yourself. Okay? Her name is Soraya Soifri. Make sure that you're here tomorrow night when we have host this broadcast. Now, my question is, now we do deal a lot with courts and that kind of stuff, but what is this business about the renouncement of your citizenship in the United States? I run across some information, and this young man was talking about that, and I thought it was very, very interesting, and I decided to make sure that I make this particular information available to people here at Morris Talk Live 100 so you can see what this thing is all about. Also, before I go any further, keep in mind that on Monday we will have Sister Ariel. She'll be coming in here, and we'll be dealing with the situation out there in Missouri and with the rights and all that. We're going to deal with that. We're going to look at that from a whole different angle. We'll have some people that will be calling in and putting their input in about this thing. So make sure that you catch us here at Morris Talk Live 100. That will be Monday at 12:30 p.m. In the afternoon right here on Morris Talk Live 100. Now, me personally, my position is as far as the renouncement of your citizenship, I have to look at it this way. First of all, how is it possible that the United States of America can be a corporation and have citizens at the same time? I don't know no corporations in the world, on the planet, with citizens. They have employees. So, because if it was possible for a corporation to have citizens, then in my opinion, Walmart would probably have a whole lot of them, but they have a whole lot of employees. So is it that the United States of America is leading us to believe that they are a country, countries have citizens, and when in fact they are corporations, and they have listed their people as corporations and employees? You reckon that's possible? Okay. I think that's the case. However, something else that I've looked at, and that is people around the world. And I look at Japanese people, Mexican people, Cuban people, German people, Italian people, and all of these different people, and they all have something in common. They all have a recognizable nationality. Okay, that's, you know, I didn't do it. You know, it's not my fault. I did not do that. The Chinese people, they are recognized as Chinese. That is the family name, Chinese. Chinese are connected to and associated with a landmass called China. Chinese, China. Chinese, China. Japanese, Japan. Cuban, Cuba. Koreans, Korea. Filipinos, the Philippines. And the list goes on and on and on. But now, we come to the United States of America Corporation. Not Washington, D.C., but Washington, Delaware Corporation. And we have all of these people inside this country, on this landmass. And we have black, we have colored, we have Negro, we have African American, we have Afro American, and a few other things that they call themselves. But now I'm trying to match this thing up, all the nations of the earth. We know that the Chinese are uniform with China, the Japanese are uniform with Japan and all that. So, but when I talk to people of African descent inside the United States that's classified as Negro, colors, and blacks, some of them tell me, well, I don't need no nationality. That's not important. And so now I'm forced to go to China and tell the Chinese people that it's not important. You need to stop being Chinese. You need to be, you need to disconnect your nationality from China because it's not important. Because we, you know, we got brothers and sisters in America that say it's not important. And, you know, I'm trying to find out where they land at, and I'm trying to figure out why they are being treated the way they are, and you know, all this kind of stuff. And so tonight I decided that we're going to deal with this thing here, and we're going to take a look at some things. But before we get down into the nationality thing, I want to look at this recourse and remedy, because it is my understanding that inside the United States, involving law and the courts and all of this kind of stuff, there is recourse and there is a remedy. And so let's take a look and see if this stuff here has any validity. Now, keep in mind that any time during this broadcast, if you have a question, you can go ahead and raise your hand. I will open up the line, and you can tell me what's on your mind, okay, involving what we're discussing here today. The title of the broadcast, Black People, Recourse, Remedy, and the Renouncement of Your U.S. Citizenship. The number to call into this broadcast is 310-982-4184. That's 310-982-4184. Now, I use a program, an administrative process, and by using that process and making sure that I have been successful at using that, I don't have a whole lot of problems. Even my mailman, he's like, you know, the only thing that I ever bring you is junk mail. I mean, I don't never, you know, stuff coming to you is not like for the regular people. I said, well, why don't you learn something about your identity? Why don't you learn something about your rights? Why don't you learn something about the law? And maybe the same thing will happen at your location where you are. I'm pretty sure it would. And so the way I see this thing is we are all faced with 24 hours in a day. Okay, we all have a day. Some days it's raining. Some days the sun is shining. Some days it's cold. Some days it's in the fall. Some days it's in the spring. But I feel like that if our Creator has given us a day, and this is something that we didn't get for ourselves, this is something that is available to us day after day after day, wouldn't it be better if you can enjoy every day, have a sense, a feeling of freedom where you don't have to be constantly worried about something, burdened down something, about things? Why don't you take control of your lifestyle? Remove the burdens of debt. Remove the chaos from your environment. Remove the fussings and fightings and drama, and get rid of all of it so that you can live in peace and enjoy the days that are given to you and the nights. And so I always feel like if you can, it's just like saying that, well, I'm going to make $500,000. Okay, I want $500,000 this year. I want to make that money. okay, what are you prepared to do in order to make the money? How much time are you willing to put in to see that come to fruition? Because if you are willing to put in 6 or 7 months worth of time, that goal, by the time you accomplish that goal, them 6 or 7 months that you invested in accomplishing that goal, you won't even remember that anymore. It's just a faded memory in your brain. And in order to do something like that, I would have to recommend that you take control of your lifestyle. I would like to recommend that you go to the store and get you a monthly planner so that you won't have to use your mind as a warehouse for thought, unless you're going to put something in there that you're going to use, you see. So if you go and get a monthly planner and you plan your days, if it's Monday, well, what do you plan for Saturday? Let's put it down on the books. When is your wife's birthday? When is your anniversary? Let's put it down on the books. When is your children's birthday? When is your birthday? What is the plan? What have you written down in that book that you know that you have to consider on that day so you can make adjustments to make sure that whatever it is that you got planned, that you can succeed at it? If you have a wife and his husband and wife, then I think that both of you all should be able to, even if you have two monthly planners, you should both coincide with each other's plans. If you only have one monthly planner, everybody should plan. Because if you do not plan to succeed, you automatically plan to fail. And your life is compassed about. You got bills coming in. You hadn't wrote down the date that they're supposed to be, the due date for the bill, so you can't maneuver. And you get paid on Friday, but you're reminded that the light's due. You forgot about it, and you had them plan on the job that you was going to go do this, that, and the other, but you forgot you got to pay that light bill, and you got to do this, that, and the other, and all this kind of stuff. So if you get your little monthly planner and plan your life and do what you have to do on a daily basis, you should look in that, on that book every day. You should start looking at what's going to go on next week, what's going to go on tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, the next day. And then you're able to see somebody's birthday coming up on, so you can plan and whatever you're going to do about that or whatever event that's going to come up. If you write it down, you got a plan and you can execute your plans. If you're going to make investments, what day, what time are you going to invest? All this here needs to be written down. Who knows? A day may come, and you may not be able to but you can reschedule it. But what I'm trying to get you to understand is we're going to have to take control of our lifestyle if we plan on making some significant changes. And if you're not recording anything and you're not planning anything, then you're kind of like an oyster tossed back and forth in the ocean at no direction. If you want to succeed at something, you got to have a plan. You got to have a goal. You should have a target. You should put it where you can see it, because that's what you're going toward. That's what you're trying to do. We got to stop the hit and miss situation. We got to take control. Now let's take a look at this recourse and remedy. And if you got any questions or comments after we come back, then raise your hand, and then we can discuss this thing, okay?
Shalom, brothers and sisters. Once again, it's the voice of Brother Tazadok coming at you through the spirit of Yahweh Bahashem, Yahweh Shah. Begin all things with that name. Today I wanted to talk to you about remedy and recourse. Once again, this is not legal advice. I do not offer legal advice. This is for educational, informational, entertainment purposes only. If you need legal advice, seek yourself a lawful attorney and please be advised. What is remedy and what is recourse? Now, every system of civilized law must have these two characteristics, remedy and recourse. Remedy is a way to get out from under the law, and recourse provides that if you have been damaged under the law, you can actually recover your loss. Now, the common war is the jurisdiction that we are to defend it, that we want to go in under. And there's a UCC code that protects that for those of you that didn't know. Now, the law of merchants, this maritime admiralty law, and even this uniform commercial code all have remedy and recourse. But for a long time, myself and probably many of you others could not find it. Now, if you go into any law library and ask them to see the uniform commercial codes, they will show you this tremendous, outrageous shelf completely filled with uniform commercial codes. When you pick up the volumes and start to read, it was, seems like they intentionally was written to confuse you. It took me a long time to discover where remedy and recourse was found. It was actually found in the very first volume, UCC 1-207 and UCC 1-103. And by the way, UCC 1-207 has been changed to UCC 1-308. So, remedy. What is it? Remedy is the making of a valid reservation of rights, preserves whatever right the person then possesses, and prevents the loss of such rights by applications of concepts of waiver. UCC 1-207.7. Brothers and sisters, it is very important to remember that when we go into a court that is a commercial court, if there's admiralty court, maritime admiralty law is being practiced, and it has an international jurisdiction, and if you go into this court saying, I demand my constitutional rights, the Constitution said this, the judge is likely to find you in contempt of court and say, if you mention the Constitution in my court one more time, I'm going to throw you in jail. Why? Because you cannot go in under one jurisdiction and argue under another. You cannot be charged under one jurisdiction and defend yourself under another jurisdiction. So UCC 1-308 or 207 goes on to say, when a waivable right or a claim is involved, the failure to make a reservation thereof causes a loss of the right and bars its assertion at a later date. UCC 1-207.9. Read it down. Go into a law library and research it yourself, and you will see what I'm telling you is factual. So you have to make your claim early. Further, it says, the sufficiency of reservations of any expressions indicating an intention to reserve rights is sufficient, such as without prejudice. UCC 1-207.4. So whenever you sign any legal paper, brothers and sisters, that deals with the Federal Reserve notes, right under your signature without prejudice, UCC 1-308, previously UCC 1-307. So whenever you sign any legal papers, be sure to write that. It is very important to understand just what that means. Don't use this if you don't know what it means. Because if this document goes to court, you could best believe the judge is going to question you what do you actually mean by writing this UCC 1-308. So when you use without prejudice UCC 1-308 in connection with your signature, you're basically saying, I reserve my rights not to be compelled to perform under any contract or commercial agreement that I did not enter knowingly, voluntarily, and intentionally. I do not accept the liability of the compelled benefit of any unrevealed contract or commercial agreement. Say, for instance, the Driver Motor Vehicle Act. So, what is the compelled performance of an unrevealed commercial agreement? What is that? When you use the Federal Reserve notes, that they call this fiat currency, instead of a silver dollar, instead of gold, is it voluntary? No. There is no law for money or other alternative. So you have to use these Federal Reserve notes. You have to accept the benefit. The government has given you the benefit to discharge your debts with limited liability, and you do not have to pay your debts. I'm not giving you, this is all for entertainment purposes. How nice, right? But if you did not reserve your rights under UCC 1-207, you are compelled to accept the benefit. And you are therefore obliged to obey every statute, every ordinance, and every regulation of that government at all levels. That includes federal, state, and local. And if you do not understand this, you will not be able to explain it to the judge. Or you understand what I'm saying to you? Do you understand what I'm saying to you? If you don't understand this, how in the hell are you going to explain it to a judge? And he will ask you. You will be asked. So be prepared to explain this in court if you sign UCC 1-308. Now, you also need to understand UCC 1-103, the agreement and recourse. If you want to understand this fully, go to the law library and photocopy these two sections of UCC. It is very important, if you go to the law library, to ask for the Anderson 3rd edition. Many of these law libraries have the West Publishing version, which is very difficult and extremely complicated to understand. And the Anderson is actually broken down into decimals in the 10 parts. And more importantly, it's written in the plain, simple English. Now, what is recourse, brothers and sisters? What is it? You heard the word before. What is it, though? What is recourse? It's rhetorical. You don't have to answer it. I'm going to break it down for you. Recourse appears in the Uniform Commercial Code at UCC 1-103.6. And it's basically the code is complementary to the common law, which remains in force. So it's in conjunction with the common law, except where displaced by the code. A statute should not be constructed in harmony with the common law unless there is a clear legislative intent to abrogate the common law, UCC 1-103.6. So this is the argument that we could use in the court, in these commercial courts. The code recognizes the common law. Do you follow me? This is what you want to use if they pull you in under this maritime amity jurisdiction and it is common. You're going to say, hey, the common law is still in effect. They tell you, hey, the common law doesn't exist anymore. Oh, the hell it doesn't. By hand, your UCC 1-103.6. By hand, the common law is still in effect. So if it did not recognize the common law, the government would actually have to admit that the United States filed bankruptcy. We've been telling you that. They did file bankruptcy in 1933. They don't want to admit that. They don't want the people to know that. They'll try and go all around that and tell you that that's not true. And if they admit that they filed bankruptcy, they'll have to admit that the United States is owned by its creditors. So it's not expedient to admit that. So the code was written as to not to abolish the common law entirely. So if such is the case, if you've made a sufficient, timely, and explicit reservation of your right with UCC 1-207, which has been changed to 308, you may then insist that the statutes be constructed in harmony with the common law. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Hope you do. So, for instance, let me break it down in layman's term, in woman's term. If you've been charged with a traffic ticket and you demand that the court produce the injured person who has actually filed a verifiable complaint, so you need a verifiable complaint. I want the injured party here. This is common law jurisdiction. If for example, if you was charged with failure to buckle your seatbelt, or you ran a red light. I'm not encouraging anyone to go out to run red lights or whatever, but just say you was charged with something like that. You didn't buckle your seatbelt. You may ask the court, was there an injured party as a result of me not buckling my seatbelt? Was there an injured party as a result of me running that red light? not stopping at that red light. Did I run into anyone? No. Where's the injured party? Did I break a contract? Show me the breach contract. Understand what I'm saying to you, brothers and sisters? Think. If they can't produce that, you should go. This is in agreement with what we just read. Who was injured as a result of your failure to buck it up? Now, if the judge won't listen to you, because many of them won't, remember, this is a game. And the intent is to not let you win. The intent is to extract as much funds from you as they can. This is a damn game. If you think it's not, then each time you get on in that court, just like a tennis court, it's a basketball court, it's a game. The judge is the referee. You're going to lose at this game. So, if the judge won't listen to you and just move on ahead with the case, then you will want to read him the last two sentences of UCC 103.6, and it states this, and I quote, "Actually, it is better to use a rubber stamp because this demonstrates that you had previously reserved your rights. The simple fact that it takes several days or a week to order and get a stamp shows that you had reserved your rights before signing the document. Anderson Uniform Commercial Code Lawyers Corporate Publishing Company. The code cannot be read to produce a common law section." So you're going to tell the judge, "My Honor, I can sue you under the common law for violating my rights under the Uniform Commercial Code. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I have a remedy under UCC to reserve my rights under common law. I have exercised that remedy, and now you must construe this statute in harmony with common law. To be in harmony with the common law, you must come forth with the damaged party, My Honor." This is what you're going to direct to the judge. Now, don't be too wishy-washy. Direct it to the judge. You are sovereign. Now, if the judge insists on proceeding with the case, just, you know, act confused and ask the question, "Let me see. If I understand this correctly, My Honor, has this court made a legal determination that Section 1-207 and Section 1-103 under the Uniform Commercial Code and this system of law are operating under, which this system of law is operating under, are not valid, is not a valid law before the court?" Say something to him like that and see how he responds then. I'm going to continue this on and conclude this in the next video. So be sure to watch part two. Once again, my name is Brother Tazadok. Shalom.
Okay, Moses, we back. Now, the brother brought up some very, very strong information and some very, very valid points. If you noticed, he mentioned contracts. And I keep telling the listening audience over and over and over, the entire United States operates on a continuous series of contracts under contract law. But now, let us deal specifically with the common law, because he mentioned that, and I would like to recommend a book to you, and I'm going to be coming to you directly from this book. The title of the book is Wills, Trust, and Estate Administration for the Paralegal, 3rd edition by Dennis R. Howard. We're going to deal specifically with his definition of common law based on the knowledge and stuff that he has put together and put into this book. Common case law. Common law is based on the unwritten principles of law that had their origin in England These principles were developed according to the customs and traditions of the community, according to what was equitable, fair, or just. Thus, a controversy taken to the courts involving simple issues was decided by the established customs of the community. But if a controversy concerned matters for which there were no applicable custom, the court judge decided according to his idea of fairness and justice. English common law principles spread to this country. Over the years in the United States, the written court decisions based on the common law principles came to be called case law, because the decisions resulted from prior decisions in similar cases. Today, the terms common law and case law have become synonymous, and legal writers tend to use the terms interchangeably. If a court is confronted with a case involving issues to which no constitutional provision or federal or state statute is wholly applicable, the court looks to previous decisions, i.e., case law, for guidance. If no prior similar cases are available, the judge's decision necessarily creates new case law. In summary, courts serve two major functions. They interpret and imply the constitutional and statutory law, and they create their own law by looking to prior cases where no constitutional law or statutory law exists to resolve the dispute before them. Such judge-made law is called case common law. Points to remember about common law are that it must not conflict with constitutional or statutory law, and that it can be altered by statute. Following is an example of a decision based upon common law. Now, we're not going to get down into that, but I want you to understand something here. What we're faced with here is a situation where we have to be careful, because we have to keep in mind that what they can do is they can create something. And we have to remind the judge that, because in a lot of cases they'll say, well, I'm going to enter a plea for you. Objection. Judge, to do perform an act like that is practicing law from the bench. You have my documentation before you. I have it in my possession. I'd like to enter it into the record. It contains all of the laws that have already been ruled upon in this particular situation. We cannot evade it. There's no sense in attempting to act like we don't see this right here. And I would like to enter my information into the record. This is precisely what happened with the young sister that came onto my broadcast. I don't know if y'all listened to her, but she was 18 years old. And her and I had had conversations and stuff, and she had gotten a hold of the materials and stuff that I have. And she was able to go in the courtroom at 18 years old and pretty much shut it down, lock it up, and that's exactly what happened. The judge attempted to practice law from the bench. She objected with the shutdown. Her documentation contained nothing but the previously ruled upon cases that could easily be verified and looked at, but she was forcing the court to put his status and jurisdiction upon the record. She was involved in a courtroom that was in admiralty jurisdiction, and everything that she had on the document was absolutely right and fair and true and visible for everybody to see. But now the court is faced with not being able to rob this young lady, not being able to handle her any kind of way in order to extort revenue or perform any acts of extortion upon her. So All you have to do is understand that the entire United States operates on a continuous series of contracts, and one of the most effective devices that you can use is an affidavit. Now, we're not talking about a whole lot of going down there and filing documents to say, well, look, I'm a Moore, and I need you to recognize me as such, and I deserve some type of privileges because of my identity, even though I don't have, I'm not listed with, I do not have the support of an existing bona fide government with its own laws and rules and regulations, guidelines and flags. And at the same time, I'm not able to provide for you proof of a nationality connected to a landmass that is specific. So if you look at the situation from a contract law situation, the Uniform Commercial Code is something that's been put in place. There are remedies available to you. And you can use these remedies. It doesn't. You don't have to go and get a whole lot of law books and study and all of this stuff and all these statutes and ordinances and all that. No, you don't have to do that. And that is my reason for reading you the common law. And the bottom line is it is the law of the people. And what I've been doing is I've been actually gathering up the laws of the people. And the actual Supreme Court rulings on these laws and formulating them correctly in a bona fide affidavit in the event that I have a situation that I have to deal with. And I simply send that to the people that I have a controversy with. I use what's called an administrative process. I don't run down that to the court, put nothing in the court. By the time I do that, I've already dealt with the situation. I've already laid it out for the debt collector or bill collector, whoever it is that you're dealing with, and given them every opportunity to do the right thing, abide by the law. So if we are forced to go into the courtroom, well, the bulk of the work is done. The only thing that you have to do now is make sure that both sides are heard. If both sides are heard, if both sides of the situation is heard, if you have already served your brother with a bona fide affidavit clearly explaining to you, to them, that they, here's the law, here's where you went wrong at. Here's the correct way right here that can be verified. Here's where you went wrong again. Here's the correct way right here that can be verified. Here is the other way here, and here's the right way, and it can be verified. And this is between you and the people that you have controversy with, not the court. We haven't even got there yet. We're going to make an attempt to settle this matter with our brother. Informally, this is an informal attempt. You know, we're just two people, man to man, trying to get this thing hashed out. Can't get it hashed out. Here's my position on paper, according to the law. Okay, so now we're officially ready. If you don't want to do this between you and I, let's bring the court in. Here's what I plan to do. This is my position right here. You've been made fully aware of it. I have copies of the fact that I've made every attempt to settle this matter informally. You refuse to do that. So now I'll do up a complaint, and we'll set it before the courts, and then we can go in there, and I can get a chance to put my position onto the record, and so can you. And then it's up to the court to decide. Based on what? Based on the law. So if we just take this little nutshell, little bitty nutshell, and just look at the situation from that point of view, for those of us who have issues, a lot of us are dealing with child support, we have student loans, we have mortgages, we have our property listed on a tax roster, and the only person that's supposed to be paying taxes is someone who is running a business in their home. If you are not running a business in your home once a year, you should not be paying property taxes. Okay, that's the law. That's just point blank. So when we look at the different angles and barriers that we can protect ourselves with, and we use these, then we can get on with the business of enjoying life and living. A lot of us are spending too much of time making a living and haven't gotten around to actually living. The book that I brought to you today is Wills, Trust, and Estate Administration for the Paralegal, third edition by Dennis R. Howard. Howard, H-O-W-E-R. Okay, Webster's New World Dictionary is a portable large print dictionary. Over 35,000 entries in large print. That is a good book to get. Another one is the Oxford Companion to the Supreme Court of the United States, second edition, edited by Kermit L. Hall. Okay, that is another one we might want to take a look at. The Glennon Guide to Civil Procedure, okay, by Joseph W. Glennon, G-L-A-N-N-O-N, The Glennon Guide to Civil Procedure. The other book is The Supreme Court in the United States History by Warren. The Supreme Court in the United States History by Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N. And the reason why I want to read these titles of these particular books off is because they are part of the books that I have gotten hold of this week, because a part of my plan on the books were to go to the bookstore and get some books. So I was able to exercise that and bring that and add it to my private library, because one day I'm going to leave this planet. And these books are being invested in to be left behind to my children and my grandchildren, so that they will be able to have a library of their own, because by the time they get up, these particular books may not even be in print, but yet they will have them in their possession, and they will be able to read them and study from them and use the materials that's contained into them. So, and I, you know, I know that you all, those of you, I don't know, maybe some new people here, but every man and every woman, if she doesn't have a husband, needs to have a small library in our home where her children can study and glean some knowledge and use that to help themselves with. So I'm building this library for them. We have an online library for my people, and that people are getting a hold of, and they're actually using the stuff that we have in there. But contract law, a continuous series of contract. Everything operates on contract. But when you have a situation, you want to formulate your documentation that you can enforce. The UCC 1-2-0-3-0-8, and the brother mentioned to you, is a very viable thing. And for those of you who have actually seen some of my documents, that information is recorded in there, okay? And so I just want to bring this out about, once again, what we need to be concentrating on when we are dealing with these people in these situations. Okay, now we're going to go into the next segment, but before I do, the number to dial into this broadcast is 310-982-4184. That's 310-982-4184. Go ahead and raise your hand. I'll open up the line, and you can let me know what you think about this thing. We're going to be dealing with this thing involving nationality, this thing about stateless people, and why people of African descent inside the United States are being treated the way they are. We got a big mess up there in Missouri, big old mess up in there, and it seems now that it's quelled down. I have a late-night radio broadcast that I listen to, and I have been hearing comments coming from different people around the country, people of African descent, people of Caucasian descent, and it is one of the most strangest things that I've ever come across. I have been listening to Caucasian people saying that we need to wait on an investigation to try to find out what's going on and what actually happened. And this, well, okay. All right, that's fine. But the way I see this thing, I'm just looking at it straight in the face. Okay. Because people are saying, well, these people, they're looting and they're doing this and they're doing that, and we don't know whether the policeman had probable cause, and this is not a racial issue, and all of this here. This is what I'm hearing from these people. But this is what I have seen with my own eyes. I have seen in all 50 states people of African descent being murdered in cold blood, shot down, no weapon in the hand. And in other states, not all, I don't know about all in these particular cases, but I know about some, lynched, burned, castrated, beheaded, shot, children fed to alligators in the Everglades, crushed, tied to cars, and drugged down the street. But we're not supposed to regard it as a racial matter. We're supposed to look at this as an isolated incident and forget about yesterday. This is what I'm getting from people. But when I mention stuff like this, then I'm immediately looked upon as being what? A racist. Amazing. This I sit in amazed wonderment, and don't get me wrong, I do have a problem with the brothers and sisters out there doing the things that they were doing with the looting and bumming and stuff. If you were going to do that, in my opinion, I think that you should have went to the area where the predominantly people live who done what they did. I think that's where you should have went to start the show. I don't think that you should have done this type of stuff in your community. And I don't think you should have, if you've gotten out in that area, I don't think that you should have done that kind of stuff there. I think you should have handled the situation a little bit differently, a little bit more quietly, a little bit more methodically, and a little bit more effectively if you're going to do something like that. I mean, that's what I would do. I'm not going into all of that because I exercise total control of the brain. Fear and skill has been swapped. So I look at things a little bit differently. However, nevertheless, we have this situation going on, and it appears, based on what I've listened to on the radio, it appears that the situation has changed somewhat, things have calmed down or what have you. And this type of thing has been going on over and over and over. European murder black people for 400 years, and black people react by getting upset and protesting and marching and throwing firebombs, throwing rocks and jumping and hooping and hollering and shouting. And this has been going on for a long time. This is, So, I think we need to look at this thing from a whole different perspective and start changing things. And then, of course, we got the Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton comes to town, and he get a big rally, and he gets up, and everybody comes out, and he's on the soapbox, and the victims are allowed to shout and voice their anger. All the energy is coming out into the air. We were shouting. I told them like it was, and all of this here business. But I did not hear about any professional skills. Nothing happened professionally. You know, nothing. It wasn't like that in D.C. with the D.C. sniper. It was very, very quiet. The entire state was shut down. Now, let's go on to the next thing. We're going to deal with the this thing about this nationality. But before we get into that, we're going to deal with the exhaustion of the administrative process. Y'all sit tight for a minute, okay? Be right back.
Hello, everybody, again. Thanks for being here. Today I want to talk a little bit more about the presumption, but I want to tie in the exhaustion of administrative remedies. This is the doctrine. It's called the Doctrine of Exhaustion of Administrative Remedies, and it's in the Black's Law Dictionary under exhaustion of administrative remedies. And it starts out and says that the doctrine requires that where an administrative remedy is provided by statute, relief must first be sought by exhausting such remedies before the courts will act. Okay, so what we're finding here is this is the doctrine, and this is the law, the rule, that you go to your adversary before you go to court. So you have to settle this with the adversary. And when you're stopped or approached by an agent, then you're in court right there, and you have to exhaust the remedy of finding out exactly what the charges really are. And the reason why I say that is because we just learned about the presumption, the rule of presumption, so we don't know exactly what the charges are because the agencies are acting under what's called a presumption. So when the officer stops us, and he's operating under the presumption that we're driving, well, we have to raise this issue before it gets to the court. Otherwise, they're going to go by this fact, presumptive fact, as if it's the truth now because we didn't object. And where we object is at the administrative remedy before we get to the court. Now, under this doctrine, a petition for a habeas corpus by a state, the doctrine requires the party to use all available agency administrative procedures before resorting to the court for relief, and requires that a party not only initially raise the issue in the administrative forum, but requires the party to proceed through the entire proceeding to a final decision on the merits of the entire controversy. See, so this means that when you start to exhaust this remedy, you have to take it all the way. Because what will happen is you might raise it at the hearing or at the initial confrontation with an agent, but then if you don't conclude it at the very end, he may flip right back over to his remedy, which is his presumption. So we have to get it all the way through and make him produce the evidence that forms or is the bolster or the basis of his complaint. Okay, and that evidence is going to be that you were driving, the evidence that he has to violate your security and show your papers. See, because we have to remember, when you first get pulled over and these agents approach us, if they want to talk to us, they're going to have a cause to ask. And that cause is either civil or criminal. If it's civil, then it's like a citizen's arrest. If it's criminal, then he's going to need a warrant. And that'll be the basis of his presumption. Now, if he doesn't have a warrant, then the basis of his presumption is that he doesn't need a warrant because you're doing an activity that he can regulate, and that would be driving. Okay, so if you're presumed to be driving, he's presumed to have authority. But what if you rebut that presumption? Okay, the form of rebutting it would be in the nature of exhausting your administrative remedy. Oh, well, wait a minute, you are presuming that I'm driving, you're presuming you don't need a warrant, but I'm going to have to rebut those presumptions, and I'm going to require you to produce the evidence now, because you're operating under presumption, not under fact. See, and if you don't meet that presumption right there, then they're going to presume it's a fact, because you didn't raise the issue. And if you proceed to the next step, then it becomes a fact that you were driving. And he doesn't have to prove it. So this is the presumption, the doctrine of exhaustion of administrative remedies is the opportunity to rebut the presumption. This is where the presumption is rebutted. Because if you don't rebut it by then, by the end of that administrative hearing, then you've agreed. And it's become a final conclusion. And this is what we have to understand. And that's why when you finally get to the court, you're already guilty. And that is shown to you by them saying, well, we're presuming you're innocent. When they presume you're innocent, that means you're guilty. So that's how they're operating, by the presumption under the exhaustion remedy. Now, if you meet that presumption, the burden of producing the evidence shift over to them, the other side, and now they have to produce it. Okay, so we need to understand the burden of proof and the burden of producing evidence and the rules of evidence, and this is how these trials operate. Basically, by these rules of evidence and the rules of court, the rules of procedure, and we need to understand that so that we can then take the proper action. So we need to learn how to rebut these presumptions, when to rebut the presumption, where to rebut these presumptions. And that's the next phase, is this action. What actions can we take? And by actions, I mean by speaking up, by filing paperwork that's going to cause the court to shift, or to even cause the court to make a determination if that court has authority to hear the case yet. Because when you go to agree with your adversary in an administrative hearing, that should stop the case from going to the next step. Because these courts don't have authority to hear a criminal case unless there's an actual crime. And they're not set up to hear a civil case unless it's brought by another individual. So we begin to see that an administrative hearing and action, there's really no cause of action, because they're operating under presumption that they don't need a warrant. And so when we go into these courts, we're giving them authority to proceed because we don't object. And once we don't object in their court, they can do whatever they want. There is no law that they're required to follow, because the law that they're following is the presumption law. And operating under the doctrine of exhaustion of administrative remedies, you had your opportunity to rebut the presumption. You failed to do so. Now you agree. So why are you arguing here in the court? Okay, so this is where why people are losing right and left. Because they're going into the court. Our paperwork and our goal is, what we want to do is to get to the court and tell the court that we're not ready to proceed, that they don't have the authority to proceed, and that they're not set up properly. And the way we're going to do that is by bringing in these agents and having them testify to the fact that they're not proceeding properly because we rebutted the presumption and they failed to meet that presumption. Okay, and so these are the words and understanding and angles that we have to grasp so that we can take the next step of taking the action, putting in the paperwork, meeting the presumption, and stopping the case cold right there and having them dismiss us on the grounds that they don't have authority to proceed because there's no cause of action stated in the plaintiff. Okay, and so next time we'll start working on the paperwork and the different items and motions or paper things that we need to put in so that we can actually take action and do something, because that's what's required in order to maintain our liberties and our freedom. So thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, the most important part that I'm getting out of that is time. We're dealing with times and dates. Okay, you formulated your document. Keep in mind, we haven't filed anything anywhere. We're going to deal directly with whoever it is that is soliciting us, or whoever it is that says that we owe them, whoever it is that say they got a problem with us, whoever it is that say we have broken the law by exercising a right that we were born with when we were traveling. So therefore, we want to make sure that when we are formulating any type of documentation to send to our brother, that everything that we're putting in that document, we know it inside out. We don't even have to have the document in order to recite it or enforce it. And we're coming straight from the hip with law. We're not dealing with something that's masquerading as law, which is public policy and all this other stuff, presumption and all this. So by the time we do, we want to make sure that we make every effort to settle any dispute that we have outside of any court, or something that's presuming to be a court, and somebody who's masquerading or presuming to be a judge, which is an administrative officer, a magistrate, which is not a judge. And so that's in every situation. We want to look at it and deal with it from that perspective. Instead of running down, yeah, I'm filing it, listen, I'm putting this somewhere, and I filed over here, and I filed over there, and all of this business. That is quite amazing to me. I hear it quite often, and I try to restructure the thinking of the people and get them to understand there is a different way that we can do this, and we want to make sure that the cards are stacked in our favor when we get ready to do this kind of stuff. Okay? All right. Always. Now, we're going to take a little quick break, and when we come back, keep in mind the phone lines are all open, and we're going to deal with this nationality stuff when we get back. Y'all hold on a minute. We'll be right back. Okay? Jim Dandy to the rescue.
number of Americans who renounced their citizenship has hit a record high at 2,999 citizens, which is actually a 221% increase from last year's numbers. So the question is, why? Why are Americans deciding to say goodbye, America, the land of the free and the brave? Now, many conservative outlets have reported that it's taxes. Taxes are evil, and the Obama administration is taxing us so much that we're losing our American citizens. But taxes are only a part of the picture. Quote, complex or costly taxes can help sway a decision, but are often only one factor. Although statistics are not available for why people say a final goodbye, many now find America's global income tax compliance and disclosure laws inconvenient and nettlesome. So it's not necessarily that we're being taxed more or that taxes are changing. It's just that the enforcement of it is becoming much more, much stricter. And that's what we're expected to see in government with foreign policy. And also that people are now much more aware of this. So a lot of expats that were outside of the country weren't even aware that they had to file taxes, for example. The other factor here that's contributing to this sort of, but renouncement of citizenship is that banks, international banks especially, are facing more pressure to report what citizens have money in their banks, especially if they have more than 50 grand at the end of the year. So citizens, American citizens outside of the U.S. are being taxed within the country that where they're living, as well as with the U.S. So they're being
double tax, right?
Totally,
right.
And they're.
So is these numbers, these 3,000 people odd who are renouncing their citizenship, the indication is they don't currently live in the United States. Is that what you're saying?
That's pretty much it. Yeah, they're retirees or expats that are outside.
They
of
They live America. Overseas. They work overseas. They have all
the
of their
vast
all intents and purposes. Right. Okay.
Yeah. And now what's happening is just that they're becoming aware that the U.S. is going to be much stricter in enforcing these rules, and they're saying goodbye. But the unfortunate thing is that it's being used in the media to say that, you know, our current administration is awful. But again, taxes have remained relatively modest since the 1990s. Nothing has really changed there. We have had some individuals, particularly, you know, Facebook's CEO, for example, renounced his citizenship and saved himself nearly $70 million through that. So there are some cases in which it's beneficial financially to actually renounce your U.S. citizenship, but there are very few cases where this happens. The people that will probably be affected the most are not the Facebook-like CEOs or negatively impacted the most, not the Facebook CEOs, but the expats, people that are retired, that don't have really rich and awesome, powerful lawyers to defend them.
Right. So essentially, but what they're doing is they are ultimately saving themselves the administrative and financial burden of being taxed twice.
They are. The thing that's interesting here, though, that you have to consider when you say goodbye, America, is that there's a 30% tax. So you need to pay a lot of times, like a lot of money. It could be a lot of money when you say goodbye, and it might not necessarily make financial sense for you.
Oh, well, there's a sort of a cessation tax that you get hit with based on your assets or based on income, or what is that 30%?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how they calculate the percentages, but it has to do with your net worth and how much income you have, your assets, everything involved.
Interesting. Interesting. So they have a final, Uncle Sam has a final kind of dip in the pocket before you say goodbye.
Yeah, and people are really upset when people say goodbye, especially rich, you know, company owners, CEOs. So this is why Uncle Sam is hitting them.
Right,
the
for
American
one last
hurrah. You're taking away our American taxpayer dollars and you're making money off of the U.S. and then you take it away. Take it elsewhere. So individuals have this sort of sentiment. They say, quote, individuals that have used offshore accounts to evade.
Check this out, guys. This is a set of Washington and Oregon and Idaho statutes. I'm not going to call them laws, people. I just want you to see these statutes, okay? All right. This is all about right to use the streets in your own private property. So I'm just going to read this out real quick. My family car is a recreational vehicle. It's defined at RCW 46.25.0501C and at WAC 308-100-210 and is not a commercial vehicle, which would require a RCW 46-2580 commercial driver's license. That's RCW 4625050. Drivers of commercial motor vehicles shall obtain commercial driver's license. However, this requirement does not apply to any person under subsection C who is operating a recreational vehicle for non-commercial purposes. RCW 4625.050 makes it clear that the alleged requirement for a driver's license does not apply to any person. Now, we all know that the word person in the statutes refers to a fictional entity, even when it says natural person or individual or human or whatever. They still have written it. They are snakes in the grass, and you can't trust them anyway. So you just say, I am a man, and she is a woman. They haven't had, as far as I know, any definitions for that, other than what we are. So, but not only that, even if you are a person, even if you are representing the fiction, this is a statute that clears the fiction of having a driver's license, right? So, this does not apply to any person who is operating recreational vehicle for commercial purposes. Emphasis added for clarification. The Washington Administrative Code at WAC 308-100-210 reads, WSA 308 blah 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 recreational vehicle definition. For the purposes of RCW 4625501C, the term recreational vehicle shall include vehicles used exclusively for non-commercial purposes, which are primarily designed for recreational, camping, or travel use. Wow, you're exempt from having a driver's license now. Look at that. Recreational vehicles are camping or travel use. Isn't that interesting? Personal use. Let's look at other laws. Now we got some other laws. Let's see. Oregon. Oregon law. Not law. Statute. I don't know why this person wrote law. They're idiots. ORS 801. 208 is consistent with both RCW and WAC and provides that commercial motor vehicle, notwithstanding subsection 1 of this section, the term commercial motor vehicle does not include the following: a motorhome used to transport or house for non-business purposes the operator or the operator's family members or personal possessions. And that's at Section C, and at Section E it says a recreational vehicle that is operated solely for personal use. Okay. And then Idaho is similar at Subsection 4 of Title 49-302. And it says, what persons are exempt from license? The following persons are exempt from licensing. Under subsection C, not used in the operations of a common or contract motor carrier, and any person is exempt from obtaining a Class A, Class B, or Class C license to operate a commercial vehicle which is exclusively used for the transport of personal possessions or family members for non-business or recreational purposes. Privately owned buses not engaged in for hire transportation are outside the jurisdiction of Division of Motor Vehicles Enforcement, NCGS Article 17, Chapter 20, blah, 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 right? I mean, you can look all this stuff up. If you want a copy of this document, I'll be glad to give you this. Just inbox me or message me in the comments below. And you can see all the rest of this and who wrote it and everything. I'll just highlight, copy, and paste it. This is from a guy in Washington State.
Okay, we're back, Mose. Now, it's time now to go down into this thing. I'm going to bring this young man on. He was dealing with some stuff involving this nationality stuff, and stateless people. And I thought it was quite interesting, and I would like to have your feedback on this when you check this guy out, because the information that he was putting out is very, very interesting. I must say, I said, well, we definitely got to give you a shot at putting this out over here so that we can take a look at it and look at what you got to say and see if any of this stuff make any sense to anybody. And if you are in agreement with this, fine. If you are not, fine. If you have a comment about what he gonna say, let me know. You raise your hand, and we can discuss this thing right here. But we're going to deal with the renouncing, to renounce your U.S. citizenship. Keep in mind the number to call in, 310-982-4184. You can go ahead and raise your hand. I'll open up the line if you got something to say. You can get in here and let me know what's on your mind. But this next plug will deal with approximately 26 minutes and 10 seconds. And this guy is going to talk to us about renounce U.S. citizenship. Who's, where's, what, when, where's, and why's, and the whole stuff about it. So I need to know what y'all think about this.
I'd like to talk about today the issue of the plight of African Americans, so-called African Americans, the black people, in this so-called free country that we were involuntarily brought to via our ancestors. That we call the United States of America. Some of us, I'm going to find, and I do recognize many of us have fallen in love with this country. Some of us are 50-50. We love and we hate this country. Many of us hate this country, to be blunt. But there's multiple reasons for that, which I plan on going into in future videos on this subject. one of the things that I'd like to talk about is today is why are we in the situation that we are in as far as so-called citizenship within the United States of America, and why we are treated different from every single nationality or national that has voluntarily come into this country, the United States of America, or illegal aliens have voluntarily come into this country. Why are we treated, African Americans, so-called African Americans, treated so differently from these people? And when I say differently, I mean be treated as we're the bottom of the barrel. Very indifferent. I've kind of recently discovered a phrase called statelessness. And statelessness, according to the definition, are persons lacking any nationality. This is a legal concept. A de jure stateless person. A de jure is a legal phrase. It is the creation of persons that exist on paper, so to speak, but don't exist in flesh and blood. So we're not even seen as real people. For example, all Americans have birth certificates and Social Security cards, state identification cards, and so forth. The names on those items are in all capital form. And so, therefore, those are created entities, de jure persons, people that exist on paper but do not exist. Well, stateless de jure, a de jure stateless person are similarly the same. They exist, but they don't exist, is how this government sees those type of persons. And African Americans, or black Americans, whatever you choose to call yourself, we fall under that description. A de jure stateless person is not considered a national by any state under the law. Stateless persons have never crossed international borders. This is the vast majority of all African Americans, so-called African Americans or blacks, in the country of the United States, in all 50 states of the United States. The majority have never crossed international borders. So you are legally, we are legally considered stateless persons. To be considered, to not be considered a national by any state. That means you do not have a recognized nationality. Soak that in for a minute. Because this is the reason why we are treated so vile in a country that totes the flag of freedom. It's a farce. No freedom, not for stateless persons or African Americans, black Americans. It's all an illusion. Understand that, believe that. All you have to do is just go through your daily lives and you will see. Go out the door and you'll see the Gestapo police in the neighborhood randomly pulling over African Americans left and right, right and left, under the guise of suspicious activity, or you have done something that looked like you were up to no good, criminality. You could be working in an all-white neighborhood as a carpenter, and a white neighbor can call the police and tell them, hey, there's some black guys over here boarding up a house. It happened to me before. Boarding up a house. I was contracted to board a house up. Board it up. And a burglary call was called in on me. I've never heard of a burglar boarding up a house. It was wintertime. The house was foreclosed on. It was my job to go and board the house, keep transients out. Luckily, I had some level-headed Caucasian officers that pulled up in the neighborhood I was in. Once they saw my invoice and paperwork and things of that nature, they let me go. But they did detain me under suspicion of breaking and entering into a residential property that I was actually boarding up. Had already had the doors boarded up, and I was boarding up the windows when they pulled up. But at any rate, That is just a prime example of the suspicious activity that you can be called upon by any person, especially Caucasian persons calling in on you in this country that we call the United States of America that toasts the flag of freedom. But freedom for who? The causes of statelessness, or the causes of statelessness, we already know what the cause of non-nationality are. You know, when persons have been forcefully brought into a country against their own will, or free will, as chattel property, slaves. Their nationality is instantly stripped the moment they are captured, and those braces are placed around their necks, ankles, and wrists. And you're put on that ship, your nationality has been stripped from you formally on paper. Okay? Causes of statelessness. It could be many issues, and one of the main issues that plague African Americans or so-called African Americans in this country is the issue of discrimination on the basis of race or ethnicity, which affects the entire minority population that's never been recognized as national. Statelessness caused by ethnic discrimination is often handed down from generation to the next generation. That has been that's openly known to the world to apply to the blacks or African Americans, so-called African Americans here in the United States. It's been this ethnic discrimination by the government of the United States and the branch governments or the multiple states of the United States of America has handed down this discrimination from generation to generation of all blacks in this country. That is sad for a nation that totes the flag of freedom. And you know, issues of discrimination on the basis of race or ethnicity. See, this sounds like ethnic cleaning to me. Ethnic cleaning. This is what Hitler did to the Jews. But as I said many times before, no one can compare anyone's experience in this country that we call the United States of America, who toast the flag of freedom, to African Americans. Not the Jews, not persons running from their country because their country is in a state of war, and they're here under protection of this government. No one can compare their experience to ours. They came here voluntarily is the major difference. We are the descendants of those that were brought here by force against their free will. And yet, we are discriminated against generation after generation after generation after generation. And it is still going to this day. Another conflict would be the conflict of nationality laws that have caused the statelessness of people. The conflicts of nationality laws, we can think of the most current Roe versus Wade. What am I going to do with these blacks? Or niggers, Negroes, African Americans, they all the same thing. What are we going to do with them? Is the Roe versus Wade. Are we going to continue giving them privileges instead of rights that are mandatorily guaranteed under the United States Constitution of America, that contract between Great Britain and the United States, that contract that was formed by the founding fathers of this country. One of the first persons to die in that Civil War was an African American, but yet and still, we got Roe versus Wade. What are we going to do with these blacks? I don't hear Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, or none of the other token Negroes talking about this. None of them are going to talk about this. They know the truth, but they've taken an oath to shut their mouths. Live for free, because I can't think of a job that neither one of these people them had, other than to hush down the rebellious spirit of peoples, their people, that have been wronged from generation to generation to generation. The oldest known case which came before the United States Supreme Court would be Dred Scott's decision. The Dred Scott case. A man, black man, or ex-slave that was fighting for his freedom to be recognized as a full citizen, a human being in this country. Dred Scott. He was turned down by the United States Supreme Court, and his decision, or the case on his decision, still stands to this day. The United States Supreme Court has handed down a ruling, and it has not been reversed, that blacks are one-fifth of a human being. And how they keep us that way? They keep us as stateless persons. De jure stateless persons. In every state in this country, we are the de jure. That's D-E-J-U-R-E, a legal term, look it up, persons. The only thing that I can possibly think of, and let me stop now, because it has come to my attention, I'm going to look further into this, that statelessness now is like something to do. It gives people power to be stateless, to be a stateless person. They can be powerful politically and economically to be recognized as a stateless person. But I think it's a ploy and a trick. I'm going to look deeper into it, and I'll get back to you later on that subject. But one of the main things that I view to be something that could be a viable weapon to breaking down this systematic discrimination, the building of prison system, locking up black people instead of giving them total freedom, the one thing that I can view, that I view to be that can be a viable weapon into breaking down the economical system that they continue to use against us, to continue to lock us up and allow foreign nationals to come into our neighboring neighborhoods, or our neighborhoods which they call the ghettos or urban areas, and open up stores without giving us the ample opportunity to open up our own stores. They don't want us feeding ourselves, but they will allow other nationals to feed us and make money off of us and run that money somewhere else. But they don't want blacks feeding each other, building stores, the grocery store chains, and feeding each other, clothing each other. They don't want that. That's something that they do not want, because then we will truly have power. But I think that one of the main things that we can do to circumvent all of that garbage that they have thrown in front of us, and to give us flat tires, will be to renounce our citizen, officially renounce our United States citizenship. I think that could be the best weapon that we all can employ as African Americans in the ghettos of America, throughout the states in America, is to renounce our citizenship, because citizenship is a privilege. But if we can renounce that privilege, that citizenship, a United States of citizenship, I think that we would be better off as a whole, as a people, and can begin to heal ourselves and build ourselves as a true recognized nation, not just the lost nation or the lost tribe, but as a recognized nation in this country, just like the Jews did. And they went over and stole that land in the 1940s, replacing the true lost tribe, sticking themselves in there. I think those people are Satan worshippers. They wear all black and they pray all day, just evil, just conjuring up evil spirits. And they are a weapon head within the Middle East. I'm not speaking radical against them. I'm just speaking the truth about the nature of those people and the nature of the people that are in cahoots with them to keep us here locked into this country as a stateless people. Renouncing our U.S. citizenship and just saying, you can have it. Forget it. You know what I mean? Forget it. Just, we don't want nothing else to do with it. Let's just renounce it. But see, it's going to take a lot of sacrifice. My people, or African Americans, so-called African Americans, are very materialistic, especially our women. We are very materialistic. And self-esteem is at an all-time low. As a people, not as an individual person, but as a people, self-esteem is at an all-time low. We're the only ones that won't stand up for our own rights, which is sad. You know, we're the only ones that will accept the murdering of our young men, and in some cases our young women, by so-called law enforcement. But they are enforcing the laws. They are enforcing the laws for those that are not recognized as non-stateless persons. They are enforcing the law upon stateless persons. So they are actually doing their job. Even though, you know, according to us, it may be in a form of discrimination, they are actually doing their job. This is what they're paid to do, to keep us down, to keep us in a lost state of knowingness of who we are. No tongue and no nationality, which is the most important, because to be recognized by any nation as a true legal form of people, you have to be recognized by your nationality. And anyone speaking different from that is a liar. If they tell you nationality is not important, nationality is as important as the air you breathe, because that is how you recognize by the nation in which you live. That is how you get the benefits and the equality from the nation in which you live. And you cannot obtain that equality if you are not recognized as a national, as a people of a nationality. You will never get it. And it is until we as African Americans and as so-called black people, as so-called Negroes, recognize that we have to proclaim our nationality, then and only then will we be treated fairly. One way to ensure that is to renounce our United States citizenship. Throw away the privilege and say we have the right. It is the only way. And once we have proclaimed that right and it is given to us and recognized by all the nations of the world, we will be treated very differently. You will see new laws come into effect that will be to a benefit to you and not a detriment. See, it's a secret they don't want us to know. That is something that we need to get on. I'm going to get deeper into this conversation with you all. Think about it. Stateless persons is the reason why we have African American descent, and as African Americans in this country are treated indifferent. We are recognized as stateless persons. I gave you the definition, and I think I'm giving you the remedy to renounce your U.S. citizenship to be recognized as a national. It is our only course of survival in this country if you wish not to have your son gunned down violently or only find out that he was reaching for his wallet or, maybe he was wielding a knife. He could have been shot in the leg, but he was shot in the head and in the torso 42 times. When are we going to say it's enough and take matters into our own hands? This is not an isolated incident that goes on in this country. It goes on in every state where black folks reside. And wherever there's ghettos and what we call urban areas, which is the politically correct term, violent, chaotic destruction of a nation of people that is not recognized as a national in this country continues. With that, think about that. And I will be back with you in the next segment.
Okay, we are back. Now, the brother said his piece is at this point. The number to call in is 310-982-4184. You can go ahead and raise your hand, open up the line so you can get in, and you can let me know where you think the brother went wrong at, or whether he was right about some things, or whether it was something else that he should have added in or taken away from, or what you think. Now's your time. A lot of times we have said, well, we don't have no voice in America. Well, maybe that was true, but not tonight, because you got one tonight. So you can go ahead on, and I'll raise your hand, and we open this thing up. And we'll see what's on your mind. The brother said stateless people, the reason why we're being treated the way we're treated is because we're stateless people. We don't have a nationality. We're refusing to acknowledge our nationality in all of this good stuff. Me personally, my position is nationality is extremely important. And it will be a major reality if we decide to do this on a national scale. However, we don't have to wait for anybody for us to proclaim our nationality. In my opinion, I don't think I need anybody to recognize me as a Moorish national. And at the same time, if my human rights are violated, or if my nationality is violated or something like that, then I personally feel like that's something I deal with personally. I'll deal with that. I'm looking at the situation this way. Okay, let's say that people of African descent decided that, okay, I'm going to proclaim a nationality. And we got, let's say we got 7 million of us decided to do that. Okay? How do we deal with the fact that people have become accustomed to mistreating you? They have been accustomed to shooting you down. I mean, it's like we have disrespected you so long to just second nature because you haven't exercised the solution to the problem. You haven't taken advantage of the solution and exercised the solution to the problem. You have looked for every conceivable way under the sun to avoid the solution and look for some other alternative way to get peace in this land, on a land that the oldest remains and fossils and artifacts look just like you, the oldest, which means that in the beginning, prior to any oppressive regimes, you were already here on the land. So the question is, who is the rightful owners of the land? And that should be obvious. The ones who are in charge. I mean, you have people that are aboriginal, indigenous. The oldest artifacts belong to them. All the scientific, archaeological, anthropological evidence point to one species of people. But yet we have people on the land that's running the land and having murdered the inhabitants of the land. There were people that were called natives to kill them. And I mean, this is not racism. These are just the facts. Now, you know, I'm just telling you the facts. These are the historical facts that I'm talking about. So we have all of this going on, and then the people that are doing these things are immigrants on the land. They came from someplace else. Say that we are aboriginal and indigenous, yet they are in charge of the land. So my question is, based on the information that the young man has put out and brought forth, is what are we prepared to do about it? What is the solution that we are prepared to use? I mean, all the facts are there. All the historical facts are there. You know, you can put your head in the sand all you want, but your tail is still sticking up. So my question is, what do you think about this? Let me know what you think. The guy said we have to have a nationality. We all become nationals, then all the racism will go away. All the lies will be revealed. All of the hypocrisy, all of the conspiracy, all of the fraud, all of the murders. Everybody will live happily ever after. Did he say that? Or did he give us any indication that by proclaiming your nationality nationwide would change everything. Well, in my opinion, I think that that is something that we should do. Absolutely. There is no doubt about it. Absolutely. But we're still, I got a feeling that we are still going to be faced with certain situations. And the reason being is when you have a runaway train moving down the track, and the people that's in charge of running this train slam on brakes, that train going to slide to a screeching halt. I look at the situation between Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. When Custer wanted to come up in there and take the land, and take the area and the mountains that contain the silver and gold and the resources and all of this. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, they didn't get along. There was a river that went through the land. And Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, they had these confrontations, these fights and stuff, but then they were divided. One people was on one side of the river, other people was on the other side of the river. And you better not come over here, and we ain't coming over there, and that big old thing. And all those other stuff that was involved with that, but nevertheless, there came a time where they both had a common enemy. And Sitting Bull sent men over there and said, I need you to go over there and talk to Crazy Horse and tell him, look, we got a problem. We got the Caucasian. He's going to take everything from all of us. And we're going to, he has a large army. We're going to need some backup. And Crazy Horse was like, well, you weren't acting right the other day. You know, why should I be going and help you about this situation here? And, you know, you and me enemies and all this right here. And I hear what you say. Stay where we at, and you do what you got to do. But now if he come over here, we got him. So they came together, they set a little plan up, you know, and they had a little men station and all that, you know, and here come Custer. Heck, he come on down the road, and we coming up in there. And they came up in there, they started fighting Sitting Bull and his crew. Boy, look here, it was a heated battle. You can hear him, boy, shouting and shooting, and it was all kind of cano going on. And he come down up in the river and went to fighting in the water, fighting across the water. He got across the water up into Sitting Bull land, but it was a fight all the way. And then when it got hot, Cousin said, uh-oh, we got a problem. We can't go back, because if we go back the other way, they'll kill us all. So we're going to have to go this way. We're going up the mountain, because if we get on top of the mountain, then we can hold them all off. We get on the mountain. So they head toward the mountain. But when they're going up the mountain, Crazy Horse straddled the mountain and his nation. And Custer knew that his goose was cooked at that point. Because they had a plan for reinforcements to come up behind him and all this good stuff, but when the reinforcements got in earshot of the battle, they didn't hear number Indians. They didn't hear no more Caucasians. They didn't hear no more Caucasian gunfire. So they got off the horse and just sit on the ground, because they knew that we go up in there, we done too. Ain't nothing for us to do. We're going back to the house. It's over. Because whatever Custer had in his mind, he ain't in there no more. But anyway, my question to you, if you disagree with what the young man said, now's the time to raise your hand. and let me know what you think about it. I'll open up lines so that you can get in, and you can let me know how you feel about this situation here involving what the young man said. Okay? Be right back.
When I say goodbye, it is never for long, 'cause I know our love still lives on. It'll be again exactly like it was, 'cause I believe in the power of love.
I
listening to Dr. Frances Quest Welsing. She told us a story about where she had, when I think she went to Russia or Germany or somewhere she was over there. It's been a while since I listened to her testimony, but she said that she was walking down the street and she didn't see no black people. It was like everybody that she seen, which she ran into, she didn't see nobody that looked like her. And she was about to panic, and she, lo and behold, she seen a brother walking the water. And she said, oh, my God, thank you. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, sir. There's a brother. So glad to see her kind or somebody that looked like her. But when she got up there to the brother, she said she found out that the brother was gay. And that was such a disappointment. I've traveled across the country. I've been down in the Florida Keys, and I go in different places, and the Hispanics have taken over, the Cubans, and I look around and I look for somebody that looked like me. Just to see them. You know, I might not even hold conversations. I just need to know that you're there, that you're still alive. Because to me, knowledge of self and love of self and the embracing of your kind come first, over and above everything else. And then we can get on with the business of dealing with other people. That's the way I see it, personally. You know, I don't think I'm wrong for that. I cannot be accused of being a multiculturalist. I'm just not a multiculturalist.
Living in a constant state of fear has never been good. Many of us fear the Internal Revenue Service. We don't know what to do about it. For one reason, we don't know what it is. Send for my free reports to tahaka53@hotmail.com. That's tahaka53@hotmail.com. We'll send our articles to you. We'll also send one good solid video that should do it once and for all about exercising your freedom of right to travel. And our second video shows you exactly what to do with your writ of habeas corpus, how to deal with these people in the courtroom, and what to send these people and how to respond to them. Send that to tahaka53@hotmail.com, or you can call me, area code 904-303-9061, before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't hesitate to visit our website, tahaka53@hotmail.com. That's the email website, www.newdateelimination.com.
Okay, in my opinion, I think that before I can love somebody else correctly, I have to love myself. Before I can embrace some other nationality, I have to embrace my own. Before I can love another race of people, I have to love my own. So I noticed that the biggest controversy that I ever had, or the biggest opposition to this type of thinking, came from the people who look like me. It always came from
in multiculturalism and racial harmony, another joke. It's not that I don't want harmony between races. You see? It's not that. But you gotta ask, what price are you willing to pay for harmony? Are you willing to pay the harmony of the grave? Oh yes, the others will be harmonious with us as long as we remain consumers, as long as we remain non-competitive, as long as we remain dependent and beggarly, as long as we don't demand our just due, then we can talk about how we get along. And yet I'm afraid this is the kind of harmony that people are talking about. Let's look at what is actually going on in our real world while we talk about harmony and love between the sisters and the brothers all over this world.
You sound right. take you to a quick trip. I know we got to go here, but I just want to take a couple of things here, because it's important, like I say, if you're going to remain sane, to look at what is really going on. As I said earlier, we are the multicultural businesses. Where are the multicultural jobs? Now, I picked up this paper this weekend, one of those free paper called Manhattan Spirit. And it has on it, it says it's the West Side's largest weekly newspaper. Heroin makes the grade, and Ivy League as Upper West Side campus experiences new drug problem. Well, they're talking about the students at Columbia who catching on to the heroin habit. Matter hard over there. As a matter of fact, they call it Columbia's dark secret. Okay. Yes. Yes. But I find it interesting, by the way. But one of the things I caught here was a segment taken out by the Koreans. What they call it, Korean America. A New York story, page 20 to 25. So we took out about 5 pages of ads here. And let's see, they're talking about various things. Let me just read you a few quotes. Here they talk about a new publication, targets Asian American youth. Multicultural youth, did they say? Asian American youth. A new monthly hailing a new age for Asian American youth has reached a newsstand near you. The New Second Generation, that's the name of it, which made its debut last November, has created a forum of communication for young Asian Americans aimed at giving a voice to a sector of our society whose numbers are rapidly increasing, but whose needs and interests are chronically underrepresented. Where's the multiculturalism here? Where's the assimilationism here? Huh? At a time when the needs and ambitions of, this is a quote of the editor here, at a time when the needs and ambitions of Asian Americans are being redefined, our goal is to play an active role in the shaping of the Asian identity. Are we talking about becoming invisible?
No.
Are we talking about merging?
No.
You know? And the kind of thing here, the 1990 census reported that the Asian population in the United States increased 100% in the last decade, now numbering 7.3 million. Okay, another recent study revealed that 33% of the Asian population holds college degrees, as opposed to the national average of 16%. And I've got news for you, the most recent set of Asian immigrants into this country have as high as 46% of people with college degrees. Compare that then with something like 13% for black folks. You can begin to see what is going on here. You're being lulled to sleep in multiculturalism. And it goes on here, but I'll skip over that for a bit, and I just want to look at something else here. Down at the bottom called Association Unites Community. Korean Americans have prospered so impressively in New York City because of their cohesion as a community. Multiculturalism here, ladies and gentlemen? Denying color? Denying identity? No. But this is the age of multiculturalism, isn't it? Yeah. And the Korean Association of Greater New York has nurtured this unity in the metropolitan area for over 30 years. They're nurturing unity, and we're trying to nurture something else. Their major organization bringing cohesion, and ours is trying to disperse us throughout the American population. The longevity and success of the association is due in part to its effort to constantly adjust its mission as the needs of the Korean community mature. Now that Korean Americans have achieved social stability and economic prosperity, the Korean Association is looking to help improve relations between Korean New Yorkers and other ethnic minorities in the city. That's your multiculturalism. We're going to be nice to you after we get all the money. And after we stabilize ourselves and stabilize our community, then we're going to deal with the ethnic relations. It's a lesson. And this is what we've been trying to tell black folk all the time. Why are you trying to integrate and let other people get caught up in it when your greatest problem is to do what? Integrate with yourself and love yourself first. And the greatest bit of multiculturalism will come from the fact that once you become a cohesive, integrated ethnic group, you can deal with ethnic, other ethnic groups from a position of what? Power. Yes, strength. You have something to trade. You have something to sell. You have something to buy. You have something then that demands their respect without you having to march and do all of the kinds of things that we see ourselves doing today. And every other group knows this is the way you do it. You stabilize yourself, you build yourself, and then you reach out. To live harmoniously with other ethnic groups, we need to reach out and cooperate one with the other. But we notice this is coming after what? 30 years of economic development. But a good deal of what we call multiculturalism is merely a new face put on advertising. You say, well, we recognize that other groups exist in the world. We want to sell them things. This is chiefly the way whites approach it. We want, you know, to them feel comfortable buying things from us. So we're going to talk about diversity a little bit. Today, the Korean Association serves as an umbrella group for over 1,000 Korean and non-Korean organizations throughout the five boroughs. It is widely recognized as the leader of Korean-American organization with its president duly elected by Korean-American voters from the entire metropolitan area. How many people know the Koreans went to the polls to elect their own leader? I know, we were so busy trying to run for president with Jesse Jackson. Okay, we didn't recognize that. And I've said often that Jesse Jackson would have been a much more powerful man if he'd run for election within the black community and served as an elected official of the black community representing the black community's interests, rather than trying to run in some general election. He could literally have led the so-called third world had he led the black community and identified with it and integrated with it and been legitimated by it. You see, because this is what groups do, who are real in the world. And it goes on here. Now, they're getting ready here, let's see, to deal with what they call charities. See, here we come, right, when it comes to the charity part. They're going to give us some turkeys. And it starts with green grocers produce results. Over the past 20 years, there has been a highly visible metamorphosis in New York's produce industry. Who don't have to know that, do we? During that period, as any New Yorker could tell you, Korean Americans have come to dominate the retail end of the business. And I'm just skipping over here. At the center of this revolution is the Korean. Did I say multicultural? Did I say racial harmony? No, I said what? Korean. Ethnic identity. The Korean Produce Association. Did I say the All Races Produce Association? No. It says what? The Korean Produce Association. Oh, but this is the age of racial harmony and multiculturalism, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Located in the Hunts Point market, which I predict they will take over in the near future. The association was founded 20 years ago to help new merchants with the various problems associated with owning a retail business in New York City. Same kind of thing that I'm trying to get black people to recognize here today. People must be directly instructed about how to do things. Why is it that in tandem with the number of degrees in business administration, black people have fewer businesses to administrate? And the more of these degrees in business administration, master's degrees, MBAs and so forth, we've gotten, the less we've come to own our communities as a people. It must mean then that those degrees are not designed for African Americans to own their own economic situation or their own communities. Those degrees, like all the other degrees, are designed to make us high-priced servants for our masters, to own nothing and to control nothing. Get them so that we can serve other people in the exploitation of our own people. No amount of going to college and getting a BA in business administration is going to tell you directly how to run a grocery store out here on this street. Because the course is not designed that way. The thing that I'm trying to get people to understand here, we need to put out these publications that say directly how to own a grocery store. Yeah. 1, 2, 3. Where is the wholesale market? How do you rent? How do you do such and such a thing? This is the kind of instruction in business we need, not some kind of lollygag theory and a lot of doggone accounting, but direct information about how to do what is real. Not something feeding a bourgeois fantasy, but something that actually feeds the people. And yet this is what other groups do. There are two curricula in this world. There's the formal curriculum in the schools, and there's the curriculum that takes place in the homes and in the businesses and in the streets of an ethnic group. And it's the ones that take place in the streets and in the homes and so forth that's the real one, not the ones in the schools. You see, and when we talk about African-centered education, you see, you can begin to see why African-centered education differs fundamentally from any other forms of education, because it looks at the problems we have to solve. I guess my time is running out here, so I'll wrap it up. But I just want to point out a couple other things here. It was founded 20 years ago to help the new merchants with the various problems associated with owning a retail business in New York City. Starting with only 30 members, the association has expanded to over 1,000. A key element of that strategy has been to share ideas and concepts which led to the revitalization of their industry. Not being educated for whom? Other folk. Not being educated to solve whom's problems. Other folks' problems, but whose? Their problems. But the Negro thinks he is really being educated when he can tell other ethnic groups how to solve their problems, but he can't solve his own. In fact, that's why he goes to school, to solve other people's problems. And he's called brilliant and smart when he can solve other people's problems, but he cannot use his own intelligence to resolve his own community's problems. The association also guides members through the gauntlet of problems they frequently encounter when operating in a foreign business culture. Interesting. I've told my people for years, you must see this business culture and the American business culture as a white culture. Stop talking about standard business practice. These are white folks' business practices. Designed to meet their needs based on their history and their experience. And when you practice them, if you practice their practices, you can only do what? Support them. There's no such thing as a standard business practice. There's no such thing as I've said before, a standard education. You understand? There's an education that meets your needs. There's an education that advances your interests. There's education based on your history, based on your psychology, based on your values, based on your goals, which are not the same as other people's history, psychology, and goals. And therefore, when you get an education that is not fitted to your own realities, it is going to work against you and destroy you. But this kind of lack of knowledge is hidden behind the concept standard education, standard business practices. No such animal. They didn't come to learn standard education, standard business practice. They practiced the kind of business that was relevant to their own reality as a people, relevant to their history and their psychology and their culture and their tradition. And it worked. But those of us pretending to be white, acting like white, have only succeeded in maintaining our separation and degradation as a people. I told people years ago, there's no such thing as a black bank, but you went on over there and you built up Freedom National to get yourself insulted. And every year it sat on that street. For every year it sat on that street, we got additional non-black businesses on it. And yet you were deceived into thinking that that bank sitting on that street would advance black economic interest. It could not. If you look at the reality of the American economic system, if you came to understand the nature of the American banking system, and if you came to understand the nature of our economic situation, you would recognize that a commercial federal bank is the most inappropriate institution for advancing a group's economic interests. You put your monies in there and financed the moving of jobs out of New York City. You put your money in these banks and you finance building of highways and sewers and suburbs and moving jobs and factories into the South or out of the country completely. Let me tell you, because the bank just doesn't hold your money. It must invest the money. It must lend the money. And what does it do? If there are no businesses in your own community to which a bank can lend money, then it has to invest its funds into someone else's businesses and someone else's assets. Yes, we're bringing it in. Which means then the African American community, because it misunderstood its own economic reality, supported the reality of other people and led to its downfall. I just want to quote one more thing here so we can begin to get some sense of what we're dealing with now. Be through it right after this one. New York Times, March 22nd, 1993. You know, I talk about education. This society can only brag about how it has freedom of information because it has succeeded in destroying black people's minds. It's a society that does not want to hide what it does to various people, and it doesn't. Every means by which it manipulates and controls and dominates is published right in front of your eyes. That's why our children cannot learn to read and must not learn to read. Because you know, ladies and gentlemen, if black people really learn to read well and acted on the knowledge that's available to us, you would get censorship in America. They would hide knowledge from you. The only way then that this country does not hide knowledge from us, it makes sure that we take no interest in reading. That we run from books. We run from papers. We run from libraries. We think reading is unmanly. You see, we get headaches when we read. We get sleepy. We see it almost as un-African. We start even making excuses for ourselves. I thought it non-linear. Why there's a linear. Yeah, we got a lot of that stuff too. People hide and think. We are intuitive people. Yeah, right. Just means you don't want to do the hard work of reading and thinking. You want to sit around and guesstimate and estimate and all these other things instead of grasping onto reality and being precise in what you're doing. Seeking new ties and clout, Korean Grocers Journal Voices. The Korean Grocers Association of New York had a surprising guest give the invitation at its annual awards meeting last month. The Reverend Al Sharpton. Not only that, they have also sponsored spots on black radio stations honoring heroes like Thurgood Marshall. The Korean Producers Association ran a scholarship program for black minority students in conjunction with the Amsterdam News. Got a picture right here. They're sending two colored girls to Korea over there. President of the Korean Association of Greater New York provides last-minute tips on life in Seoul, Korea. Provide life in America, tips on life in America, man, to three young students, black people. Sit here. Merrill Griffith, Elizabeth Ortiz, and Duana Evans, shortly before they left earlier this month for studies in the Asian capital on a scholarship program established 2 years ago by Kung Hee University for African-American students. A total of 100 scholarships were given to studies on the undergraduate and graduate level. under the arrangement, students are to be sent in groups of 20 over a 5-year period. Come on. Come on. Typical neo-colonial game, typical brainwashing game, and how cheaply we can be bought as a people. Giving away millions and billions of dollars for a few stupid scholarships, and for some people who are going to come back and convince us that it's in our interest to support people who exploit us. Yes. And I see them buying the Amsterdam News almost every week. There's some scholarship being handed out to black students. On a range of issues, Korean business owners in New York are using the strength of their numbers to try to increase their political influence and improve their business opportunities. And perhaps most important, mend their bitter relations with other ethnic groups. Told me years ago, what do you do first? You get the economic together first. There's no power without economic power. Negroes thought power was in voting. Power is not in voting. Power is in money. Power is having control over major resources. And any ethnic group that's smart gets this first, and then it moves into the political arena, not the other way around. Yes. And the Grocers has enlisted municipal help to set up a huge new food co-op to cut their costs drastically. Who are they going to sell the food to, huh? Community relations initiative by them and others have included taking black leaders on tours of South Korea and sending black students to study there. And now they're going to push their concern by voting as a bloc in this year's mayoral race. They've made a collective response, and you know, they're going here. The organization is trying now. You were complaining so much that it wasn't that the Koreans were taking livelihood and taking your money out of the community, not living, not sharing, but just coming in today and taking the money out. You know what our complaint was? They don't smile at you when you come in. They look like they're mad. You know, and they learned that all black people need is a smile. They give you every number and nickel in their pocket. They'll rob their own children of a livelihood. They'll starve them. They won't keep their money to educate their children, even though they complain about it. Smile at them. Say hello. And they'll just lay it on you. The organizations now are trying to change the behavior of Korean business people so that they are less likely to spur a negative response. This has been done partly through extensive advertising in New York's 4 daily Korean newspapers and 3 cable television channels. And seminars are being offered to teach Koreans to smile more frequently, something they say is rare in their culture. Boy, what a smile it is for you, huh? Their total sales approach $1.5 billion. It's thus hardly surprising that the giants of the food industry, from Anheuser-Busch to General Mills, streamed to the association's second annual food and trade show. Did they say multicultural show? No, last month. The Grocers Association, they give a little history to Koreans who remain in the food business, and they go on here and they talk about, now what are they getting ready to do now they've got clout? Fighting sidewalk competition.
Uh-oh.
Okay?
Uh-oh.
Yes. These competitors have numbers of, now, more than any other issue, it is peddling that is energizing Korean store owners to register and vote. Their goal is to drive the city to crack down on illegal vendors and more tightly regulate legal ones. Black men pushed into the street, kept into the street, and now we get a group of people who rise up on the black man's money, and what things do we get? We turn around now and he's going to use his clout to run them off the street. But of course, how can they not consider us fools anyway? People who went and fought in Korea and died in Korea, whose blood was shed in Korea, whose blood will still be shed in Korea tomorrow if the North Koreans decide to attack or the Chinese decide to attack. And while we were dying and fighting for them, they could have come over and enjoyed the privileges that we could not even enjoy at the time. And while our monies and our tax monies and so forth were going to protect this peninsula, going to make this peninsula a safe place for the white boys to invest in so that they could get rich. While black tax money was going to Korea to build highways and infrastructure, while black money was going to invest in the building of industries and the stabilizing of government, something that the United States never did for African nations of African people, even though it was filled with African people on its very soil. We are dealing here then with the people who should have come here and given you thanks for the sacrifices that you made in protecting their lives and ensuring their freedom. And yet what we get a bunch of white folk who believe that they owe the Koreans a living and who support their becoming wealthy so that they can turn right around and run even the vendors off the block of New York City. This is because people believe in fantasies and will not deal with reality. Ladies and gentlemen, racial identity is not a joke. It's not a thing. It's not just a custom. Identity is the source of a people's survival. It is the key to people's survival, because identity is the basis upon which they organize themselves. They act in unison and act as a collective. It is a means by which they share one with the other and structure their relationships in such a way that they enhance their living and they protect their very lives. And I'm telling you today then, ladies and gentlemen, in this age of multiculturalism and racial harmony, that if the black man does not reestablish his identity, and then if the black man reclaims his identity as an African man, an African woman, unless we reclaim African consciousness and identity, our days on this earth are not long. Thank you kindly for your attention.
Multiculturalism, and that was dead on time. Let us recap and let's see what we have done here this evening and what we have brought across the platform on Blog Talk Radio. We have dealt with nationality. I've discussed love of self. We have dealt with associating yourself with the U.S. corporate entities and all that. So we have quite a bit of information to digest here this evening, some things that we need to think about so that we can make intelligent decisions. Number one, you cannot afford, and this is my opinion based on what I have got from investigated studies of my ancient story as a man that's so-called recognized inside the United States as a black man. You cannot afford to not put yourself, your color, and your kind first before going on to becoming multicultural. Otherwise, you will not be taken seriously and you will not be respected. Now, what other people will do is they will lead you to believe that they respect you, but they can't. How you gonna beg somebody who don't have no knowledge of self, no identity, no nothing, just we just out here. We just, you know, I want to look like you. I want to wear my hair like you. I want to wear the stuff like you. I want to send my children to your colleges and universities so they can be like you. I don't want to do nothing identified no kind of way with myself and my own kind. Ain't no way in the world you can be respected. You can't be trusted. You cannot be trusted because you have no knowledge of self. There one but one sign that went throughout ancient Kemet, and that's, man, know thyself. Come on, man. It wasn't there by accident. It wasn't there. It was there for a specific reason. Now, after you learn everything that you could possibly learn about yourself in your ancient story, in your ancient culture, now you are officially armed. You're officially armed. You can look every man on earth in the eye. You can look him dead in the eye. You can stand straight up and look him dead in the eye. He can come to you and tell you anything he want to tell you about what he think about history, but you standing right there to straighten him out. I had a man. This man, he just purchased a new store. He's a Greek. He had four sons, big strapping boys. I come in there and I say, good morning. He said, good morning. You know, and he went to talking, and he was talking to his son, and they was talking about this, that, and the other. And I said, what's your nationality, sir? He said, well, I'm from Greece. I said, oh, okay. I said, I've done an extensive research on Greece. I say, I'm a researcher, and I do quite a bit of research. I have a little library and stuff. His next question was, have you ever heard of Alexander the Great? I said, well, wait a minute. I said, great, Alexander the Great? I said, I've never heard of Alexander the Great. I've heard of Alexander the Greek. I said, because everything that I learned about him was the fact that he was a homosexual, and there's nothing great about a man bending over and letting another man stick his phallus in his rectum. I cannot see any greatness in that. Of course, his sons begin to come to daddy's rescue because this man is attacking the icon. He's not saying what, and then he's a black man too. We've never heard this kind of thing before. I said, well, sir, if you, his son, well, First of all, I said, well, first of all, and I don't mean any offense to you. Don't get me wrong, because everything that I'm saying to you, I can verify and bring the books in here so you can see it for yourself. I said, but the so-called Greeks were never literate people. You hung on the outside, the outskirts of ancient Kemet. You never were illiterate people. What the United States have done is given you a platform to appear. But let me lay the facts out for you. Here's Aristotle, Plato, Socrates. These were thieves of my ancestors, not attributed to all these thousands of books and stuff that they have folded, written. They stole my ancestors' work and put their name on it. I would like to bring in a certain book so that you can see it for yourself. I'll bring them in if you would like, so we can get it all straightened out. But after that confrontation and that explanation was provided, anytime I go in that environment, I'm hailed as a god and respected by these people, because we got it all straightened out according to the facts. No man can respect you if you do not respect yourself. So therefore, according to you, everybody that look like you come first. Your country come first. Your culture, people that look like you have to come first. Then we can get on with the business of dealing with somebody else. And if we can learn that and master that, then we'll be all right. We'll be all right. It doesn't have anything to do with hate. We only laying the facts on the table. And you can point out to me where these facts are incorrect. And if you cannot point out to me where the facts is incorrect, then we have a different situation. I don't know about you, but that's just the way I deal with the situation. It doesn't have anything to do with hate. It doesn't have anything to do with racism. I mean, I don't know nobody on the earth that likes to be lied to. I don't know nobody that likes to be lied to. I don't like to sit still and just sit there and let somebody constantly lie to me when I know doggone well they lying. So it's important for us to have the facts and to study the facts and make sure that we have the facts indoctrinated upon our brain. We have a lot of people of African descent who live in the so-called ghettos, who live in the rural areas, who live uptown, who live in the bad part of town, who live in this, that, and the other. But one thing I can say about them people, they are surrounded by each other. Their consciousness is in regard to each other. Their children grow up around each other. So their consciousness is intact about each. Only thing that they may need is a little more enhancement on reading, writing, and arithmetic. So we cannot frown upon our brother that might be we consider this are less fortunate than us, because we think that we can afford a new Cadillac, a $200,000 home surrounded by white folks. We have arrived and don't know nothing about your own self. Amazing set of circumstances. Sometimes I marvel at the things that I hear from people. We do not understand that we are all we got We're not looking at the equation sometimes. We don't understand that the United States ain't got no money. They got fiat. Debt. Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They still in it. The Federal Reserve is steady cranking out paper money that don't have now ounce of gold behind it. All you got to do is go to the bank and tell the bank examiner, I got a $100 bill. I need to exchange it for real money, gold, because I worked for it. They gave it to me. I put in the labor. I need you to exchange it for me. Now, don't let them call the police on you because they ain't got nothing in there. They only have debt. So if we reassess our thinking and start looking at each other in a different light and start making more efforts to make progress. You know, we go to the football game, we go to the Super Bowl, we go to this place and the other, we go and you don't have to be rude to anybody. But what I suggest you do is have a full knowledge of self and a love for self and embrace self in kind, and then you can get on with enjoying yourself. You don't have to go up to nobody and say, well, look, I can't talk to you because I'm a black man. I love everybody that's black. No, we ain't doing it that way. What we're doing is we're telling you to study your ancient story, study your ancient culture, embrace everything that is involving about you. There'd be some bad stuff, there'd be some good stuff. That's all right. That belongs to you. It's about you. Learn. We can learn about George Washington Carver. We can learn about Martin Luther King. We can learn about Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad. We can learn about all these people. That's just a smidget of what you need to learn. We need to go all the way back off the continent, all the way back over in ancient Kemet, all the way back into the deepest regions of America, to the Olmecs and beyond. We need to get it on. So anytime any hypocrisy or any lie crop up, we're able to quench that fire. Then you be respected because you are quite a force to be reckoned with. When somebody start trying to blow some smoke, it may fit everywhere, but it won't fit up your butt because it's already plugged up with knowledge of self. Now, don't be surprised if you are attacked and despised and hated and rejected by people that look like you, because we got a lot of people that look like us with brain damage. That's the bottom line. That's the only way you can put it. And the reason I say that is because I've already been through it. Been there, done that. Done seen it up close. I mean, it's amazing how the brain operates when faced with somebody that's going against the status quo, that's going against the grain. Maslow done said, I'm going to make you a supervisor. You in charge of this whole area over here. But then you got this one brother that insists on being comfortable with himself, his own culture, and his own story. And you don't know what to do with him, because every time you come to him with multiculturalism, it don't seem to fit. That coat, it don't seem to fit him. Every time you come with a God said we're supposed to love everybody. Well, say that wrong, maybe so. However, everywhere got a starting point. Where you going to start? You got to start with you, don't you think? And if you start with you, you might come to the conclusion that there's something that you need to know about the God thing that they say you're supposed to be involved with. Nevertheless, we're coming to the close of the broadcast. And I'm hoping, and this is my greatest hope, that you all have gotten something out of this broadcast. And don't forget, tomorrow we will have our special guest in here dealing with our director and producer of the upcoming film, and it's right there on my wall. You can see it for yourself. So make sure that you're here to see that tomorrow night at 7 p.m. For the Love of God, a short film was produced and directed by, let me make sure I got her name right. I don't want to mispronounce the sister's name. But the name of the broadcast is For the Love of God. Her name is Soraya Soy Free. And she'll be with us here tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana LB. And until next time.
Telling you I mean what I say. last time I'm telling you to stop that jive. Oh, yeah.